Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Intersection where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Reuben Stern. Last week, Governor Jay Nixon announced that in 2011, Missouri set a new record for exports. The $14.1 billion figure tops a previous record set in 2007. That good news might help generate support for Governor Nixon's job creation plan, which he's been touting since his State of the State address last month. The governor's plan, called the Missouri Works Program, aims to lower unemployment in the state by, among other things, selling more Missouri-made products overseas. The governor also wants to increase training for veterans and encourage the creation of jobs in the automotive sector, in the high-tech industry, and in rural communities. But can the governor's economic development plan deliver on its promise? And how are the various proposals likely to fare as they make their way through the legislature in the coming year? Our guest today will help us understand the outlook for some of the governor's recommendations, and we will probably also explore some other ideas that might put Missourians back to work. First, Stephen Weber is a Democrat from Columbia, representing the 23rd District in the Missouri House of Representatives. He's a member of the House Economic Development Committee. Prior to getting elected in 2008, he served in the Marines in Iraq. Welcome, Stephen Weber.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Glad to have you here with us on a snowy day in Columbia.
Absolutely, yeah.
Also with us in the studio, Ann Zaire is a Republican from St. Charles, representing the 18th District in the Missouri House. She chairs the House Economic Development Committee. Previously, she worked with the St. Charles County Economic Development Council. Welcome to our studio, Ann Zaire.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Thanks to you also for driving up in the snow today. On the phone with us, someone who did not drive through the snow to get here, is Daniel Meehan. He is the president and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. He also serves on the board of directors for the Missouri Technology Corporation. Welcome to our program, Dan Meehan. Glad to have you on the phone with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we hope that you and our audience will join our conversation today as well. What do you think would help get unemployed people back to work in the state of Missouri? Give us a call. Share your ideas. Our number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org or go online and join our conversation in our chat room. Just go to kbia.org and follow the link for Intersection. I thought we'd start by walking through a few of the governor's proposals. And I thought, Representative Zaire, maybe we start with you. How much can Missouri rely on increasing exports as a driver of the economy?
Oh, I think that's pretty important, and I think it's very probable. You know, we put the freight forwarders bill up again this year. Representative Mike Lira has sponsored it, and we heard it a week or so ago in our committee, and exec'd it out that same night because it was essentially the same that we've passed several times before. And that's what we wanted to do, is really move those bills forward that we had heard several times and vetted and received support from both chambers. And the freight forwarders bill is the first part of the China Aerotropolis China hub concept.
Right. So people probably recognize the China hub. Right. But what exactly would this bill that has been introduced do?
This would incent exports to international destinations from an international airport, specifically the St. Louis area. So it would give a tax incentive after the cargo had been shipped already. What we wanted to do is build capacity and encourage those freight forwarders to ship everything to the St. Louis area and then ship them out internationally. So the second part of that in Aerotropolis was the warehouse component, you know, to incentivize the development of warehousing for those types of goods and materials to be warehoused there and then shipped out. But we really thought it was a better idea to increase the capacity and build the demand before we incentivize warehouses and things like that. So, I mean, we're actually attracting this type of activity by offering this incentive. And the incentive isn't offered until the goods have been shipped.
Right. Dan, maybe you could help us understand how attractive is that to businesses in Missouri to be able to receive some sort of incentive for shipping goods out of St. Louis or one of the other airports?
Extremely attractive. If you are in the global marketplace, if you're importing or exporting, to have that port of entry with a greater proximity to cut down your travel time and cost to, let's say, Chicago, Dallas, L.A., wherever it might be, it just adds more value to your product, and it makes it cheaper for other folks to buy around the world. And that's why we've been such a huge supporter of the whole idea of the air cargo hub in St. Louis. We've made great strides towards that. We greatly appreciate the work of Ann and Steve's committee on this and putting it out so early. We realize that it's a tough slog to get an economic development bill through without having resolved the whole tax credit reform issue, but we greatly appreciate the committee's work and Representative Lira's bringing that up. It makes a huge difference in the attractiveness of your product.
Right. And you mentioned the tax credit issue. What's different this time that would cause the tax credit issue to not get in the way? I mean, the tax credit issue was kind of...
That's why I say it's a heavy dose of reality to realize that there still hasn't been agreement on how to reform and rein in the tax credit programs, specifically low-income housing and historic preservation. And so it's going to be tough to get anything through without getting a resolution to that. We saw that in special session last fall. We saw it in the regular session last spring. But it doesn't take away the importance of these issues and the importance that Representative Zaire has placed on getting these issues out for consideration independent of one another.
Okay.
If I could
please
address
this, Stephen Weber.
One thing we saw in special session that we're all aware of are there are particular senators who don't want to see any sort of economic development bills passed this year, really of any nature. And they've made the argument that we should do tax credit reform first. Maybe that's a legitimate argument. Maybe it's not. But what we've decided to do in the House this year and what the chairwoman has decided to do, which I agree with, is that we're not going to sit back and just say the Senate and a couple senators are not going to pass anything, so therefore we're going to sit in our hands this year and just say, well, there's nothing we can do. In the House, we've decided that we're going to go ahead and pass some bills that we think are good bills for Missouri. We're going to send them to the Senate. The freight forwarding bill, we've scaled down tremendously from $360 million to $60 million. So we've already cut the size of the bill almost to a seventh of what it originally was. And we're going to send it over to the Senate. We're going to see what they do with it. And if they decide that, you know, for their own internal reasons, they don't want to pass the bill, then, you know, we'll have to try again a year from now. But we're not going to just wait and just waste an entire year sitting on our hands because two or three senators decide they want to gum up the process.
And, you know, Steve, the whole of the House agrees with that.
Absolutely.
You know, both sides. Mm-hmm. Both sides are saying here, we really need to put people back to work. It's that important. And we can't give up on that that work that we're doing. So the House is lockstep here.
And one bill that we might talk about later, the data center bill that just passed on the floor.
Right, right.
That was darn near unanimous. That was 155 to 4 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of these are not really controversial bills, but they become controversial in the Senate. And I think, you know, Chairwoman Zaire and the Speaker have decided that instead of just saying, well, we know that there's a problem on the other side of the building, we're just going to give up this year. We've decided we're going to do our work. We're going to pass our bills. And, you know, we can't control what they do. So,
right.
And you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
You know, something may break. Somebody may have an epiphany on how reform should take place and maybe hearts can soften and something happens. So I'm optimistic.
Yep.
Hopeful.
No, and thank goodness for the House having that spirit and realizing that we really shouldn't let any more time go by before some of these initiatives are brought up and considered and passed. Thank you, guys.
Let me jump in and remind our audience that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about state government efforts to create jobs and get people back to work in Missouri. With me in the studio are State Representative Stephen Weber, a Democrat from Columbia, and Ann Zaire, Republican from St. Charles, both of them members of the House Economic Development Committee. On the phone, we have Daniel Meehan, President and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. For those of you in our audience, what do you think would help put unemployed people in Missouri back to work? We'd love to hear your ideas. Give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Or call in with questions for our panelists if you'd like to do that. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA, and it's offered as a video stream online at kbia.org. You can join our conversation by calling in on Monday afternoons or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Before we move off of this idea of exports, Daniel, I wonder if you could explain a little bit. If exports are a great opportunity for Missouri businesses, why aren't they already capitalizing on that?
Well, we have been, and we've been growing that area of the economy. But I think what we're identifying here is that it's a national trend, that if we grow exports, that means more people are producing those goods or services in the U.S. and in Missouri. And to be more aggressive at accessing those markets and providing those opportunities to compete is what's critical. I was lucky enough to go with Governor Nixon to China last fall and on his trade mission, where there were some fairly good deals brought home. And that's what it takes. It takes engaging literally with the world and being out there in that marketplace to push our goods and to make sure we have the best way of delivering those, which is, again, why that air cargo hub is so important. And also that we have a pro-business climate, that we can encourage employers to grow and prosper here.
There's an economy of scale issue as well. And I think that's what a lot of the freight forwarding is sort of aimed at doing. You know, the first flight costs a lot more than the 1,000th flight does. Once you've established the routes, once you've established the patterns, once you've established all the infrastructure, you can export relatively cheaply. It's really getting over that hump that's expensive. And so I think the approach we've taken this year is reasonable, where a lot of people had heartburn about the $300 million in warehouses. So we said, we're just going to do the part that's pulling the incentive, the $60 million in freight forwarding, meaning that we're going to subsidize the actual exporting until you've sort of gotten over that hump and you've created the economies of scale where it's cheaper and it can be a self-sustaining flood from then on.
You're exactly right. And that $60 million over 8 years,
right.
it sounds like a lot of money, but if you look at that in the context of the overall budget and tax credit programs, it's not that much. And like Ann said, I believe earlier, none of those benefits, none of those credits are issued until that employer, that freight forwarder, is in operation exporting goods from St. Louis. So it's a responsible way to do it. And what Steve said is absolutely right. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing. If you say, hey, I'm going to fly once a week to Shanghai and back, that's not as dependable, as reliable as you need if you knew that there were three flights a day, like what happens out of O'Hare. So once you develop it, that's why you have to develop the market so you can create that reliability and that dependability that the shippers need. So it's like I said, chicken and egg. It's hard to start, but once you get it rolling, like Steve said, you get over that hump, and it can be a really good thing for the region.
And China isn't the only country that's interested, I understand. Is that correct, Dan?
That's correct. When we were focusing on China, because our trade's grown so much with China, in less than 10 years they become our third largest trading partner. 10 years ago they were not on the radar screen with us. But once people around the world heard about that first spoke in the hub was going to be with China, then we received contact from Brazil saying that we'd really like to look at St. Louis as a destination. Brazil's China's largest trading partner in South America, and you can't get there on a direct flight. You have got to refuel, and why not do that in St. Louis and make it truly a hub?
Dan, I'm curious. You said you were on that trade visit. What else did you hear? What are other ways that Missouri could increase its trade with places like China or, you mentioned, Brazil?
By being there and by promoting the what we have to offer. And also there's also the familiarity that you only get after engaging with a trading partner or in this case, the Chinese, when they have delegations coming over to visit St. Louis, we sent several over to Beijing, China, or Beijing, Shanghai, Hangzhou, you name it. And you develop a long-term relationship that stretches beyond the international trade portion of it. So it's being out in the marketplace, having competitive products and pricing, and again, having the business climate to sustain that back home.
And when we talk about Missouri goods going overseas, are we talking about Missouri's agricultural goods, or are we talking about manufacturing? What's the breakdown of that in terms of the amounts of things that make up that kind of number?
What I always like to say is, do you think our trade with China is going to increase, decrease, or stay the same in the next 5 to 10 to 25 years? And it's a whole host of things. It's an extremely hungry society there for improved productivity, for agribusiness goods, whether it's processed food, whether it's literally live hogs to replenish their herds that we found out during this debate. There's a gentleman out of mid-Missouri that flies a 747 every 11 days to China with live hogs or live horses in it. It seems incredible, but these things are happening, and they're happening elsewhere right now. So we want Missouri to take its piece of the pie. Nobody can take our location away from us, and we believe that with our interstate system, with the second and third largest rail terminals in the country, the river system, the air system, we should be the logistics and distribution center, not just for the Midwest, but for the entire country and the entire continent. So that's why I commend the House for taking action on this and, you know, putting it out there just in case we can break that logjam that we know is going to happen in the Senate.
Right. Representative Dare, your thoughts on that?
I was just going to ask you, Stephen, about that. I wanted to make very sure that, I mean, China or anybody else can import, ship stuff to us all day long. But I think it was very important in the development of this language that we incented exporting
right.
to an international destination. And
the way this is written, no credits or nothing is given away unless it's an export, unless the plane goes back full. It's not import credit, which was a concern earlier, and that's been addressed, and that's not
right.
That's not.
It was a
concern
earlier,
right.
But this year I think we kind of cleaned that language up.
Yeah,
and I'm glad.
And back to your original question, the credit is structured differently in terms of if you're shipping perishable goods, which cost more because they have to be refrigerated, so there's an extra incentive for those, which would be like agricultural products versus more durable goods. So that's sort of addressed in the language.
And how do you ensure that those are goods that wouldn't otherwise be sold here in the United States? The idea is to increase the amount of production coming out of Missouri,
right.
create new jobs. How do you guarantee that stuff that's new production in the state and not things that would otherwise be sold here?
Well, as an economics student, I think that the market does take care of that, right? Those goods might have been sold in the United States, but if they have a market which, they would only sell if it's a better market, so they wouldn't, cut their prices to do that. And then B, they're going to increase production in order to meet the demands of both. And that's the real goal, right? The goal here is to stimulate production so that you're meeting both the domestic demand as well as a foreign demand. By stimulating that production, so a company that, sells goods here in the United States now is a new market, they now have to produce twice as many goods, they have to go out and hire additional people. And that's the real purpose of this. If we don't get to that point, then it hasn't succeeded.
Right. Is it written in the legislation that it's only new production that gets incentivized in order to ship it out?
It's not in this legislation. That's a pretty hard thing to regulate, whether it's new production or old production. But I think that in this case, by expanding a market, almost by definition, you're going to have to increase your capacity to produce. You're going to have to invest in your own infrastructure. You're going to have to hire additional folks.
Okay. Let me remind our audience once more. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about state efforts to create jobs. With me in the studio are State Representative Stephen Weber, a Democrat from Columbia, and Ann Zare, Republican from St. Charles. Both of them are members of the House Economic Development Committee. On the phone, we also have Daniel Meehan, President and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. For those of you in our audience, we're going to come up to this a little more, but are you someone who runs a business? And if so, what would have to change in order for you to hire more people? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org or join our online chat at kbia.org. Just follow the link for intersection. I want to move on to some of the other things that the governor has thrown out there as potential sure. ways to get more jobs in the state. He's one of the things that he proposed is more workers in high-tech careers, getting people ready mm-hmm. for those kinds of jobs. What does that mean? What would it take to create more of a high-tech workforce here in the state of Missouri? Stephen Weber, I'll throw that to you first.
All right, well, I think it's an incredibly appropriate question here in Columbia because I think that this, the first answer that I come up with is education. And if I could expand on that, this is sort of an area of interest of mine. One thing that we have done a poor job of is matching the skills of our workforce to the demands of Missouri employers. And let me give you an example of that. There are a lot of folks here in central Missouri and across the state who are trying to improve themselves, who want to get a better job. They apply to school. They apply to community colleges. They apply to the University of Missouri. They go there, and they do fairly well, and they apply to a certain program. One that really sticks out in my head is health professions or engineering. Engineering is another great example, particularly in terms of high-tech jobs. Right. They're told by the university that even though they have good grades – the program is so full that they can't be admitted. They have to go somewhere else. And what happens is they graduate with a degree they didn't come here to get. The field that they end up getting a degree in is full and there's no demand for jobs. There is an employer out there that is looking for somebody with these high-tech skills, whether computer skills or engineering skills or health profession skills, and they can't find anybody here locally to fill that void. And so what they do is they go to other states and they go to other countries, and they bring workers here to fill that void. Now, how frustrating is that, that when we have over 8% unemployment, we have people who are trying to improve their lot, who are trying to find jobs, we have employers who want to hire people, who want to expand, and the two can't communicate, they can't get together because there's a bottleneck in education because we're not training our workers appropriately. And I have documented this with multiple deans here at the university, with Dr. Jorgensen, who's the president of Moberly Area Community College. I'm sure that, you know, in St. Louis region, St. Charles, I'm sure sure, that's a similar way. Problem. And you've got people who who are desperately trying to hire folks. I mean, there aren't enough jobs for everybody. I agree with that. But the myth that there aren't no jobs is inaccurate. There are employers who are trying to hire folks in these high-tech fields, and we're not providing Missourians the skills and tools they need to fill that and to benefit themselves and to benefit those employers. And that's incredibly frustrating.
You know, that's why Representative Huff's bill on – it's a rework of Compete Missouri and the mm-hmm. training. I think it's MoWorks training component. It takes the individual training funds from used at the community college and from the state level and kind of combines those and makes a streamlined program mm-hmm. that can be tailor-made. And I think that's important. We have to start tailor-making these training programs because every high-tech, I mean, you could get a four-year degree.
Right.
And that works a lot. But sometimes it's somebody that needs to be retrained, somebody that needs to be specifically trained in a specific area, expertise area, you know. So I think by us making it more flexible, and that's something that the legislature can do. One thing that they can do is kind of propose this kind of reworking and streamlining of training dollars available that they can be customized.
And who would do that? What would that look like? Would that look like the University of Missouri taking orders from businesses on what to teach, or how would that work exactly?
Well, it might be different in a four-year institution than right. than kind of what I'm speaking of in a community college level and a specialized training in high technology skills, in applied sciences, and you know various even computer ISO, you know, and I'm not as up on it as I was about a year ago, but
right.
but I think it's a combination of enabling and fully funding higher education as much as we can.
Right.
And
we can earmark funds. I mean, there's things that we can give, you know, grants to community colleges that are committed to expanding programs in certain areas, high-tech areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking with here just Moberly Area Community College because it's a local one, and they were talking about a computer programming class they have. They said the professor made more money over summer break and in Christmas break as a consultant than he did when he was teaching the rest of the year. And they kept him around for a couple of years, and inevitably he left to go make more money in the private sector. And so they had to cancel the class because they couldn't find anybody to teach the class mm-hmm. who would work for that salary. So we can earmark funds for expansion of certain programs without getting, you know, too closely involved in what the university is doing with the internal workings of the university. And I think that's vitally important for increasing, you know, technology jobs moving forward.
And how likely is it that that would make it through legislatively?
To be honest, it's not very likely. Well, let me rephrase that. The part that, that Chairwoman Zare was talking about,
yeah,
with the streamline of DED programs, existing programs, I think is fairly likely. Mm-hmm. The part of additional funding, you know, a lot of this comes down to the tax debate. And I will say this. There is no doubt, there is absolutely no doubt that taxes deter certain behavior. Absolutely. Right? So if you put a tax on an industry or a business, you're going to deter people from going into that business. There's no doubt about that at all. I completely agree with that. That being said, if we don't educate our workforce, there's sort of a down point where low taxes become a problem. And there are certain taxes that you can apply that don't deter or that deter behavior we don't like. For example, collecting and something the local Columbia Chamber of Commerce has endorsed, collecting streamlined sales tax, collecting internet sales tax, right? If you go downtown right now and you try on some clothes and you figure out what you like and then you go home online and you order it, you can avoid the collection of sales tax. Well, that's not fair to the local business who you just used to try on clothes. And if you can collect that additional revenue, then we can take that revenue and we can put it into job training programs. Mm-hmm. So we get in the tax debate. We should keep an open mind that it's not higher taxes or lower taxes. It's which parts of the economy are you going to tax and which parts are you not going to tax?
Right, because there are people who would say if business wants trained employees in a certain way, then why isn't business paying to have that happen,
sure,
right?
Well, to be fair, in a lot of cases they are. There are a lot of small businesses or – sorry, there are a lot of businesses that are giving grants to universities and saying we need you to produce more people. Here's $1 million. See what you can do with it. But in a – I mean – we're a country. We're in this together, right? And you can say that at some point about anything. You know, you could say that about first grade education. If employers want kids that'll employees that can read, they could train them. But we don't take it that far. You know, employers or once employees have those skills, they're portable, which means that for any given individual employer, the incentive to train that employee is less than it is for society at large. And that's why we, you know, have public school systems and why we fund them.
Right. Dan, I want to give you a chance to weigh in here in terms of the disconnect between the needs of businesses and the number of people who are trained to take those high-tech jobs. What are you hearing from the members, the businesses around the state in terms of the jobs they can't fill because there aren't people trained to do them?
They're very concerned about that because there are those opportunities out there. Steve mentioned engineering, for one. There are those opportunities there for those who have gone through that training. If you look at any manufacturer, you look at the automotive manufacturing, which actually is on a bit of a rebound in the state with recent investments by Ford in the Clay Como area in Kansas City and by GM out in Wentzville near Ann's district.
Mm-hmm.
And those lines are more automated than ever, and it's not just the major assembly lines, it's the supplier base as well, that computer-aided design, whatever it might be, that there's a higher, more technologically driven component to these things than we've ever seen before. And when you look at the fact, this is a fact, that 35% of the freshman class at the University of Missouri this August will need remedial math and remedial reading, that is where we need to focus. We're not doing a good enough job in getting our kids ready for these opportunities out there. And it starts with that base, that foundation of knowledge that just is not being created nearly widespread enough to handle what goes on in this economy out there.
Okay, I've got to jump in, Dan, because we're going to have to take a break here. I want to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about plans to create jobs in the state of Missouri. We're going to take a quick break, but I hope that you'll stick around and join us after the break. Feel free to give us a call, 882-8925. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about Governor Jay Nixon's proposals to create jobs in Missouri and other ideas that might help get people back to work. With me in the studio are State Representative Stephen Weber, Democrat from Columbia, and Ann Zare, Republican from St. Charles. Both of them are members of the House Economic Development Committee. And on the phone, we also have Daniel Meehan, President and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. For those of you in our audience, do you know someone who's been out of work? If so, what do you think might help that person to land a job? We'd love to hear your ideas on how to get more jobs in the state. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to move on to some of the other things that the governor has thrown out as proposals. The next one, I thought, it's a little related to the high-tech stuff we were talking about. He's proposing more innovation in science and technology as a solution to job creation in the state. And Stephen, you might be the one to start us off on that. Connect the dots a little bit for us here. How does investing in science and technology lead to people getting employed?
Okay, a couple ways. First, as the world has developed economically, it's become more competitive, and it's a good thing that we've helped pull the world up from 1945 when the rest of the world lay in ruins. One impact of that is Missouri employees and American workers face competition like they never have before. The way that we win this game is by doing things here in the United States and in Missouri that can't be done anywhere else. In order to do that, you have to have education, which we talked about earlier, and you have to be in high-tech fields like biotechnology. We are incredibly blessed here in Missouri, and I went on a tour a couple years ago. I think you went on as well with the MoBio, Missouri Biotechnology Association. We were on a bus for a week, and we traveled around and toured different biotech facilities in Kansas City and in St. Louis. And between the Danforth Center in St. Louis with doing some amazing things with plant science, and then over in Kansas City in the Animal Health Corridor with Stowers and a bunch of other folks, we've already got a really strong base for high-tech biotechnology careers, and we can really develop things here that the rest of the world will have to follow, and that's the way you stay ahead in a competitive environment. Now, one thing we managed to pass this fall, which was a huge accomplishment, was MOSIRA, which was going to take tax revenue from a lot of these biotech companies and reinvest it in the biotech field. These kind of jobs, when you're cutting edge, when you're leading the world, you don't have to worry about competition from places like China because they can't do the things we're doing here in the United States. And that makes what we're doing here incredibly valuable, which means that we can hire more folks to do it. And it makes those jobs safer because as long as they're at the edge of the wave, that there's less competition for those type of things.
Right. And in terms of taking that to the next level and, from a legislative standpoint, what do you do with that? I mean, you could allocate more money, but the university's getting its money cut, for example.
Which is incredibly frustrating.
So where does that happen? How do you wind up encouraging that legislatively in a scenario like Missouri is facing right now?
Mm-hmm. First, one thing that was a problem a few years ago that's less of a problem now is sort of a threatening legislative environment that we were going to crack down on for a variety of social reasons on these things. And that there really hasn't been an issue lately, which is a good thing. Second, we have targeted tax incentives. And we talked about that earlier about taxes definitely create a positive or negative incentive one way or the other. And so we've decided this is a field that we want to lead the country and the world in, so we've targeted tax incentives there. And then third is the piece that we addressed earlier. We do have to find additional money for education because, as Dan was saying, if 35% of our incoming freshmen are doing remedial math, the chances of them going on to eventually achieve PhDs and do groundbreaking research are fairly small. So we need to do a better job educating everybody.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. I'd like to bring her into the conversation. Joan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Thanks for joining the program, for calling in today.
I'm thinking about young people that graduate from high school or either get their GED but are not going to go to college. And Columbia area is so frustrating. We have so many educational institutions, and yet we don't have anything comparable to LenTech or Nichols Area Career Center for training young people to make a living wage with some technical skills. And I would really wonder why we don't think in those terms. I'll take my answers off the
Okay. Thanks for your question, Joan, and for calling in today. And we'll put the question to the panelists here. Stephen, maybe you start us off, and then we'll hear from Representative Zay as well.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, a four-year degree is great for a lot of people, but we shouldn't let ourselves be sucked to the mentality that's the only thing that matters. You know, I mean, there's the job market for certain two-year programs or tech programs are far better than they are for somebody who graduates with a degree in political science right now. And my dad's a political science professor, so I can say that. You know, a lot of it goes back to not funding community colleges, and then not expanding, including technology schools. You know, we're cut funding, state funding, to community colleges by about 40% from where we were in 1997, and that means that a lot of folks who, like the caller was talking about, like Jim was talking about, who graduate from high school or get a GED, they don't have access. And that's what's unfair to criticize folks for being unemployed or being poor when they're trying to improve their lives and we're not giving them access to higher education to improve themselves. The MAC, the president of MAC, Mobile Area Community College, told me that almost everybody in their two-year occupational therapist assistant program, two-year program, almost everybody was either unemployed or making minimum wage when they started. When they graduate 2 years later, they make about $40,000, and the placement for people that pass the statewide boards is 100%. So you're talking about in 2 years going from making minimum wage or unemployment to making $40,000 a year. The problem is that they're getting three times as many qualified applicants as they have space for. So people that Joan was referring to are underemployed. They're making minimum wage. They can't find a job, and they're trying to improve their lives, and we're not providing the access or the access to the means to do that. And that's incredibly frustrating. Mm-hmm. She's completely right.
Well, would it make more sense to allocate spending toward programs like that where they can guarantee to put students into jobs rather than things like incentivizing exports that may or may not actually get to jobs?
I think there's a lot of four-year institution. There's a lot of higher ed here in Columbia. But I know in other parts of the state, we have taken a look at more tailor-made programs and the customized training. And there's a lot available from the state level. And I believe that the community colleges are getting more flexible mm-hmm. in their approach because we really don't have enough money in the state. We just don't. And each year we're squeezing blood out of a turnip. So we have to get, and you've heard it before, leaner and meaner, but we also have to look more creatively at how we deliver those training services. And I agree with Joan. It's LinTech is a great example of a technical education. We did something in St. Charles a couple years ago called the Manufacturing Skills Institute, where we asked small businesses, high-tech small businesses in our area, what do you need in training? They said, you know, we don't need somebody necessarily with a four-year degree nor a two-year degree, but we do need some specialized training as in computer or even welding, you know, mm-hmm. just something in the
Absolutely.
High-tech.
Good point.
And we partnered with LinTech, with the community college, St. Charles Community College, with UMSL, University of Missouri St. Louis, and with Lindenwood University, along with the Economic Development Council, to tailor-make these programs that these small businesses needed. Now, a small business, they can't shut – they got four guys working. They can't shut their doors to go send them to training during the day. So we had to bring the training to them in the evenings, for example. We had to make it affordable, and we had to make it specific to their need. And that's a success story.
Right. And what about the trade-off there? I mean, you know, limited amount of tax revenue for the state to spend on programs like this. What about that trade-off between educating students for jobs that they could definitely get if they had access to that education, as opposed to spending the money on business incentives?
I don't think it's a matter of either or. I think it's a matter of being smart. And like what Ann just made, that's a great point. And that's something that's a common error where we say, hey, we're going to increase access, so we're going to fund all these programs, and they're going to be daytime programs, and it turns out nobody can go to them because nobody understands that they need night programs. You know, I think I'm sure that a couple dollars in that night program are far more effective than doing it during the day. And, you know, with the tax incentive programs, you know, finding the right programs and doing it the right way is tremendously beneficial to the state. You know, putting a ton of money into a poor program, and we've just blown a lot of money. So I think if we're smart and we're methodical, I think it's not an either-or choice. We can mm-hmm. do both. We can attract businesses with good tax incentive programs, and we can educate our children. And they're complementary.
Mm-hmm.
People are making $40,000 a year are going to be paying taxes where they weren't when they were making $15,000 a year. So that goes back into the system. You know, a cargo hub in St. Louis after a couple of years will become a positive revenue generator. And so it's not as simple as either or. It's about being smart and making wise decisions.
Well, and we have to train the folks, don't we? But we also have to have businesses. We have to attract the businesses to provide the jobs.
So they can work somewhere.
I think that I agree with you. They're complementary. But we have to have a balanced approach to everything because we can't put all our eggs in any one basket.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, I'd like to hear your perspective on this. Which one do you think is more important to the businesses in the state if they had to choose?
I would agree with what the other two guests said. It doesn't have to be an either-or thing. And for each business out there, it might be a little different. If you're trying to expand your market, you need that export opportunity, but you're not going to be able to fill those orders unless you have a qualified workforce. So, or quality workforce, I should say. So I don't think it's white or black here, but it's gray. And you can't put it this way. You have to compete on all levels because the others in the competition are. So to give up on one area just solely for the sake of another, I don't think will get you there.
Is one of them more acute than the other in terms of where the businesses stand now for a lot of employers in the state? Like, do they need more training and more workforce development, or are the incentives what's holding them back from or what would open the door for them to expand and grow?
Well, I think economic activity is the basis. We need to generate more economic activity, so we do have those opportunities out there. Right now we're starting to see an uptick in the economy, but it's generally thought that it's not enough to sustain it. So you need to generate those opportunities out there or help prime the pump, so to speak. But again, one thing will cause the need for another. If you have more opportunities, you're going to need to expand your workforce, hopefully create more jobs. And when you do that, you're going to run up against the same problems that you're finding out there and finding people that have the skill set that you need in your facility.
Right. A reminder again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about state government efforts to create jobs. With me in the studio are Missouri House Representatives Stephen Weber, a Democrat from Columbia, and Ann Zare, Republican from St. Charles. Both of them are members of the House Economic Development Committee. On the phone, we have Daniel Meehan, President and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. For those of you in our audience, do you think tax incentives are a good way to encourage companies to create jobs? Give us a call. Share your thoughts. Our number, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And feel free to call in with other ideas or questions for our panelists. I want to move on to another part of what the governor has proposed as a potential driver of the economy, and that's creating jobs in rural communities. That he stated as one of his goals with the Missouri Works Plan. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how viable that is. I mean, how realistic is it that plans from the legislature or from the governor are going to be able to get more industry, more jobs, of whatever kind of jobs, I suppose, mm-hmm. into the small communities across the state rather than just some of the bigger areas where there already are fairly large communities. And I wonder, Dan, maybe you start us off on that question and then we'll come back into the studio with our panelists here.
I'm sorry, the question is...
Just what would it take in order to create more jobs out in the rural areas of the state and not just in the cities?
Well, for one thing, you've got the same challenges, I think, that you face in the cities is finding a quality workforce. Steve's talked about over the area community college, and having those community colleges out there in more rural areas is a huge benefit to have the workers be able to train closer to home. I tell you one thing that we need to learn from is another unfortunate example in Moberly, and that was the whole Mamtec plant. And some of those areas in rural Missouri may need a little more assistance and a little more guidance when they get into a situation like that than what they got, and were left holding the bag. So I think it's a partnership that with the Department of Economic Development, with the administration, that they can help out when needed. And it's continuing to push for those opportunities that we know exist in the world economy. I mentioned agribusiness products for export. Well, that's obviously got a rural origin to it, and it's those types of opportunities that you can pursue that fits your geographic location in the state best.
Right. And so you mentioned the Department of Economic Development. Do you think they should take a bigger role in terms of trying to line up and vet deals like the MAMTEC thing?
Well, I think they need to – they should be there as a resource. I don't know how to mandate their role. I would guess that the representatives probably don't have a direct idea on how to do that as well. But and hopefully, I think a more proactive push by the department to let people know that they're there as a resource and they can help out and vet these things. It's more of a marketing thing internally to the state of Missouri. The department also markets the state around the world, but marketing what the department can do for these different areas. I know a lot of what we encounter throughout the state, not just rural but in urban areas as well, is when you get towards the mid-size and smaller companies that are out there, they don't know what they don't know. When and what I mean is what incentives are out there, what potential benefits are there that the department can offer, whether it's the differing departments or not. But they need to. We need to do a better job in letting those companies that don't have the same sophistication as a Boeing or a Hallmark to go out and grab these incentives. We need to do a better job in making public what it's already public, but being more aggressive at marketing what the state has to offer for small and medium-sized businesses.
Right. Yeah. Stephen Wepper, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I want to let me give you an example here in Columbia. We're a town of about 110,000 people, right? And we're a pretty sophisticated town, I think. I mean, we've got a volunteer mayor and city council, but we've got a full-time city manager, and we've got a lot of resources. We decided to build a new parking garage over on 6th Street, right? You're familiar with that.
Oh, everyone in Columbia likes to talk about the parking garage in downtown, yeah.
So we had a sophisticated town, decided to build a parking garage. Everybody agrees we should build a parking garage. And that parking garage that got built is nobody in town expected the parking garage to look like that, right?
That's the contention that a lot of people bring up, yeah.
I haven't talked to anybody that expected to have a behemoth parking garage.
I imagine the construction company that built it probably did.
I'm sure they probably did, but the rest of us didn't, right? And so we're a sophisticated town. Now, take a town that's a tenth our size and is trying to do a deal halfway around the world. You know, if we have a difficult time, and we did, trying to figure out what kind of parking garage we're going to build so we can all expect – try doing that type of negotiation. I think that's what Dan was talking about in terms of a lot of these small towns just simply don't have the resources to do a very complex negotiation. And like he said perfectly, they don't know what they don't know. And so having more assistance like that helps rural communities. Another thing, I mean, this stuff all ties together, right? The freight forwarding piece, as he alluded to, is – partially geared toward agricultural products. And then the auto suppliers bill, which we haven't really addressed yet, but what we did a couple of years ago, we put in some pretty substantial resources to try to keep the Ford plant, and successfully keep the Ford plant at Clay Como. And that's thousands of jobs in that community. Now, that plant is supplied by dozens and dozens of smaller plants, suppliers scattered around Missouri, some here in Boone County, and throughout rural communities. Now, those rural communities, by definition, don't have a plant that's got 1,000 jobs, because if they did, they wouldn't be rural. But they do have small supply plants that employ 20 or 30 or 40 people, which are a huge factor to a rural economy. I mean, 20 jobs in a rural town is substantially has more of an impact than it does in Columbia. And so one thing that we proposed doing, and Representative Chuck Achenberger is carrying a bill that Jeremy Manzera is going to pass, I think, through the Economic Development Committee, is to expand some of those incentives we used to keep Ford at Clay Como out to suppliers, which by one of the goals of that is by bringing in smaller companies into the fold, you are having a positive impact on rural Missouri.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. David Rossman is on the line. David, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks for joining the program and for calling in today.
No problem at all. One of the things, and I want to preface this by saying I am a commentator with the Missourian, and one of the things that I have written about over the years has been public transportation. Now, coming from Denver, Colorado, the regional transportation district there, which runs from north of Boulder to south of Colorado Springs, including Denver, is a major method for a lot of people to be able to get to and from work from not only the bigger cities, Jefferson City and here in Columbia, but from a lot of the smaller areas, Mexico and Moberly and Boonville and Fulton. And I'm wondering what your panelists are thinking about in terms of the possibility of a regional transportation district. We know here in Columbia, the absence of a good public transportation system does keep a lot of people from working.
Okay, let me go ahead and put that to the panelists. Stephen Weber, we'll start with you and then Representative Zaire on this. The viability of transportation to get people from rural areas to jobs that are in more urban places.
I just got off an Amtrak train at about 1:30 in the morning yesterday, so I'm a big fan of large-scale transportation. I was going to Chicago to see my brother. But that's a really good point. And we're sort of moving away from maybe what we're more professional. We work on economic development into some larger social issues. But one thing that we do have a problem with in this country is it is financially difficult for people to work. By the time you put in, you know, child care costs, transportation costs, if you're not making enough money at your job, if you're a low income person, it's almost not financially good decision for you to take a minimum wage job when you've got to drive there and you've got to have somebody watch your children. And that's a larger, much larger issue, but I think that's a very important one. It's one that, you know, we work on here on the city with, I've talked to the mayor a few times about trying to improve the bus system here in Columbia. And I actually go to the university as well. I'm a law student there. And so I've tried to talk to other students and seeing the importance of, he's trying to bring in some of our dollars as well. It's an incredibly important issue, and it's something we should work on.
Representative Zaire, your thoughts on that, connecting people to jobs geographically as opposed to just moving the jobs to where people are?
Yeah, and you know, America's been in love with the car for so long, and we just drove everywhere, and it's just not feasible now anymore. And I would be all for regional districts to try to pay for this, but that's where you're going to get the money. You know, you've got to put the money up front, and the payback is later. The big dig in Boston, I think that was a $1 billion project that really upgraded their public transportation. But it's a model. It's a beautiful. I mean, they had a little engineering quirk for a while there, but and I don't say that lightly. They worked through that. But it's more on a local issue, isn't it? That you have to pay for it on the local level, in partnership with perhaps the state and the feds. But we really do have to start planning for that type of transportation. I like rails too. I mean, you know, we were built, this country was built on rails, and it's underutilized.
One challenge we have as lawmakers is trying to strike a balance between what we think is ideal and what we think is pragmatic. You know, what our dream policy would be and what we think we can get done. And I absolutely completely agree that a regional transportation plan would be very important. If we were to go to Ashland, to Hallsville, to Moberly, to Macon, to Sturgeon and say, hey, we guys want to put some money together, we're going to create this regional district, and we're going to have a vote on it, there is absolutely zero possibility that we would ever pass any sort of revenue increase to pay for that. It's not happening. It's the chances are zero. And that's where it's frustrating, where you see a need, but you also understand the reality of people aren't going to fund that. And if people aren't going to fund it, then we got to find another solution.
Mm-hmm. David, does that answer your question?
Well, the answer is yes and no. I have my own arguments in both ways, but I do appreciate the answers.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in and joining the conversation today.
Thank you.
Yep. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. We have a few minutes left. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in at 573-882-8925. I want to move on to another area that the governor has suggested, hiring more veterans, figuring out ways to get veterans more employed. Is this a problem, and how big of a problem is it, and is that really going to drive the economy? Stephen Weber, you're a veteran. I want to throw that to you first.
Okay, let me break this down. First off, veterans' unemployment rates are significantly higher than they are for non-veteran Americans. And we already have a pretty high unemployment rate. So we're looking at 13-14% among veterans. Within that, that's actually a worse statistic than it sounds, because it shouldn't be that way. By any objective standard, veteran unemployment should be lower. And the reason for that is, one, you have a group of self-selected folks who joined the military, who showed initiative to volunteer for something. They almost entirely have high school diplomas, maybe a few GEDs, but far over 95% of high school diplomas. They've been screened for mental illness and other disabilities at one point in their life, and they passed that. They have some sort of job training, and they have work experience. So there is, on paper, veteran unemployment rates should be significantly lower than the public at large, and they're not. And that means that there is something else going on there. The simple truth is this, and I'll criticize President Obama on this one. I'm a Democrat, but the bill they passed in Washington was a bunch of junk. What they did was they took a bunch of money. They gave tax incentives for people to hire veterans. Mm-hmm. They paid for it by taking veterans' fees from veteran mortgages. When we get VA home mortgages, they were going to get rid of those fees, and they kept those fees, and they used that money to offset the cost. So they basically took money from veterans and are giving it to other folks to hire them to give us jobs, which is a bit insulting. The issue is not that people don't want to hire veterans. People do want to hire veterans. The issue is that a lot of veterans who are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan have PTSD and mental illnesses that make it difficult to work. And you can throw tax credits around all you want. If somebody can't sleep at night, if somebody is an alcoholic, if somebody's on drugs, if somebody's depressed, they're not going to make it to a job at a given time. That's the problem. The problem is not that there's not opportunities out there. It's that somebody who can't sleep because they have nightmares and is depressed, right, can't get out of bed to go to work, and they're unemployed. Until we solve those issues, which cost money, then everything else we do on veterans' issues is just
so. What I'm hearing you say is that there needs to be money spent on mental health for veterans, not
Absolutely.
Job training or job incentives.
No, because if you look at the numbers, there are certainly veterans out there who come back who don't have those issues, who face the same problems that other Americans do with lack of job training and access. That's absolutely true. But if that was the case, the numbers would mirror the numbers for the public at large. In fact, they'd be a little bit lower. The fact that they're not shows there is a different factor in their working, because all these veterans have some sort of job training skills, some sort of work experience, and at the very least, they should be equal to everybody else in the country, and they're not. The issue is mental illness problems, PTSD problems, and we can put window dressings in all we want, and I think that people from both parties at all levels of government have done that. But I've got friends who go to the VA. The VA says, "Are you going to kill yourself?" They say no. They say, "Okay, good. Come back in 3 or 4 months." It's the timeline.
You're saying this is a federal issue as well?
Well, state, absolutely.
I mean, is there something the state could do that you'd like to see happen?
Let's see. There's a couple things that I would like to see happen that would help veterans. I don't know if it would directly translate into reducing unemployment rate among veterans. What they've tried is the Show Me Heroes program, which would link up people who are inclined to hire veterans. That's a good start. And I mean, that does do some positive things. Because like I said, there are some veterans who don't fit that category. But to actually tackle the problem, to reduce it to what the state unemployment average is, it's going to take some huge federal dollars. And there's no other way around it.
Okay.
Or state investments in mental health.
Okay.
Which
is a whole other conversation that I hope we'll have one day. But for now, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to thank our guests, Missouri House Representative Stephen Weber and Ann Zare, and Daniel Meehan, President and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour every Monday from 2 to 3. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions, and participate in our online chat. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Leah Becerra. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks a lot. Have a great week.